The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Every time you look at something online, you're confronted with a barrage of advertisements. Dancing cartoons on the side of the page. Pop ads that obscure your view and follow your eye as you scroll down. Autoplay videos that are nearly impossible to close without getting tricked into visiting a vendor's website. They are annoying, and in the past few years, they've become increasingly aggressive. And as ads have increased, so has the desire to be free of them. More and more programmers and developers are making software that helps consumers block those ads. Now, we thought it was time for a primer on ad blockers and find out what their proliferation means for the internet as we know it. Rob Fleischman is with us. He's principal engineer at Akamai and our chief explainer of all things Wired. Oh, Rob, thank goodness you're here.
Great to be here, Virginia.
We need to know what's going on here. I mean, the name says it all, but what exactly do ad blockers do once they're installed?
Well, right. I mean, ad blockers remove or alter ads, right? So what are these ads? You know, like you said there, pop-ups, pop-behinds, autoplay, video, graphics, audio. They're kind of annoying, right? And they sometimes come as Flash or other types of media that show up in your browser. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember what the point here is, right? I mean, the point here of these ads is to make money, right? And you know, it's sort of this catch-22 situation, right? We want the web to be open, and we don't want to pay a lot for content, and we want a lot of stuff to be free. But, you know, nothing really is free, right? It has to be supported by something. And those ads really pay the bills to allow us to get a lot of that content. What's happened, of course, is that the ads have gotten worse and worse, right? Everybody's seen the ones that block the content and
scroll with you. Ugh, drives you crazy. You try and move it and you can't.
Right. I mean, the developers like me are spending a lot of time to make them annoying, so you must look at them, right? And that, of course, has made ad blockers proliferate. I mean, AdBlock and AdBlock Plus, which are the top two plugins, you know, have over 40 million users. So that sounds like a lot, but it's really a small amount. I mean, it's still single-digit percentages of people that use web browsers. And the other thing that's happened here with ads is some of them aren't so friendly, right? Some of them are capturing your browsing techniques. There's been malware inside of ads. It overlaps sort of with content control. You know, what kind of ads do you want your kids to be able to see, right? Some of these ads may not be kid or family friendly.
Okay, so the ad blockers that are being developed to get rid of those are also ad trackers. Now, what's that? I'm not sure of that terminology.
Okay, well, you have to think about the way these things work, right? When you download a web page, there's, of course, a bunch of things embedded in the web page, right? There might be your content, but, you know, when you download the New York Times web page, it has all these pointers kind of off to different ads and graphics all over the internet. So what happens is when the web browser goes to retrieve those, the ad blocker gets in the way and looks at them and says, this appears to be coming from a domain that I know is an ad server, like DoubleClick. That's a big domain that Google runs that serves ads. So it might say, hey, this is going to DoubleClick. I'm going to stop that. I'm going to fill that in with just maybe a blank square rather than display the ad. Or the ad blocker looks at it and says, hey, this is going to a network, a part of the internet I know is where ad servers live. Or finally, it looks at the content type, meaning, oh, this is a Flash video or an autoplay audio. So I'm going to stop that from happening. So that's the way those things work. And because they see the stream, right, and they see the destination, they get a little bit more information about you, right? And also, every one of these ads, when the retrieval happens, they send with it information about you. So when you go off to the ad server, and when you're on the New York Times website and you pull up an article, the ads that come with it might have an ID in there that identifies the article or the type of content in the article. Or maybe that it's Virginia Prescott. and she has certain interests. She's a radio host, so she might be interested in certain things that radio hosts might be interested in. And that information gets forwarded off to the ad site, and the ad can be customized for you.
Well, they've been around for a long time, but now, just recently, big news from Apple that the latest edition of their operating system is going to offer built-in support for ad blocking. Now, this is, people are just going crazy about this. This is the end of the internet, I'm seeing in some places. Is it indeed? And why would Apple, a company that's built its life around the internet, do this?
Okay, well, there's a lot of confusion here, so let me make it really clear to everybody. First of all, when it comes to blocking ads or filtering content, there's a lot of stuff that actually is built into your web browser already, right? So if you fire up IE or Chrome or any of those guys, you'll see that most of them have things like pop-up blockers built in, right? You don't need to download anything. You can just go to the preferences and say, do I want to show pop-ups or not? You know, those kind of things. So there's a lot of blocking in there. Also, if you remember, there's something else in there called cookies, right?
Right.
And every one of those web browsers has the ability to limit cookies. And if folks remember, cookies are these little things that get sent out that talk about your history and remember who you are and help websites.
And so when you're filling out a form that says your name, address, it will autofill that because of a cookie.
Because of the cookies, right. So browsers already, out of the box, have some of that stuff. So ad blocking, all these additional plugins, like I said, things like AdBlock and AdBlock Plus, have been around in web browsers for many years on the desktop. This announcement is that Apple has allowed iOS 9, which is the operating system for the iPhone, to allow Safari, which is the web browser on your phone, to have ad blocking. So the interesting news is this is the first time that a mobile web browser can have ad blocking software. Up to this point, all this ad blocking has been for the desktop. So this announcement is a big deal because it's the first time that any vendor has said, hey, you can add ad blocking software to your mobile browser. Now, that's big because mobile has been, of course, this huge new platform where there's been a tremendous amount of revenue. You know, I don't have to go into how every company like Facebook and Google and everybody is saying, hey, all the money's in mobile, right? And of course, where's the money? It's from the ads. So here's this first time a vendor has said, we're going to let you put a plugin into your mobile browser that cuts off that advertising money. So it's a big deal.
Okay, so how does it serve Apple?
The big loser here, as I said before, are people like Google.
So this is a strike against Google.
Well, there's another thing that people forget about, and that is that this is just a plug-in for Safari, for your mobile web browser. Remember that everybody on the iPhone uses apps, right? And those apps are not a web browser. Those apps also display ads. I mean, we've all played games and used apps on our phone, and we see ads in the app, right? Those are called iAds. They're Apple iAds. And those will not be subjected to this.
Those crafty apps.
Exactly. So if you think about it, you know, Apple doesn't really get a lot of money from those online web-based ads, right? So an ad blocker plugin for mobile Safari, you know, there's not a tremendous amount of downside for Apple, especially when those iAds, which are only purchased through Apple, only available in all the apps on the iPhone, will not be subjected to this.
Okay. So
now you kind of get it, right?
I do. You know, they've always got a strategy. But how about content providers who are saying this is the end of the internet? They've been very vocal, saying in some cases that the use of ad blockers is akin to stealing. How do you see it?
Well, you know, I think there's some evidence, and I think everybody has a piece of the truth on this one. Clearly, when you're a site like New York Times that's providing content, you know, for low cost or free, and of course they do have a subscription version where you can pay, but for folks that provide content for free, you know, those ads are what pays the bills. So I get that. I get that.
And it's not just the New York Times. It's people who have blogs. It's people who, you know, say, like, I make my money on the internet using ads.
Absolutely. You know, it's really cuts them right across the throat, you know, really tough to justify, you know, allowing ad blockers and really stealing from these people. I mean, I get that. I think they're right. I think they have a point there. On the other hand, you know, we can play the net neutrality argument. And that says that, you know, you control your computer, you control your equipment, you can do and run whatever you want to run, you know, and who am I to say what Virginia can put on her PC? I think that perhaps, as we go forward, I think that we're going to start seeing the blend of ads. Like, for example, you know, you're watching a movie or a video, and all of a sudden it's like a TV commercial, right?
Right.
Your video is interrupted.
Ads.
Exactly. The ads are going to be inside the content itself. You know, I mean, we're seeing product placement. You know, you're watching some sitcom and all of a sudden there's a Coca-Cola container on the counter, you know. So I think we're going to see more and more of that. You know, will ad blockers explode on mobile? I don't know. You know, they haven't exploded on the desktop.
Do you use ad blockers?
I actually don't. I don't. But, you know, I browse mostly the NPR website, which doesn't have ads. So I'm all good, you know.
Well, Rob, you're in the right place. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Rob Fleischman, he's principal engineer at Akamai and our chief explainer of all things Wired. Now, we do have links to some of the recent articles on the pros and cons of ad blockers at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are a lot of inventions that make people appear more beautiful to others. Orthodontics, alcohol, Spanx. Then there's the little dial on most household walls that may have done more to change our mood and improve our self-image than any other, and done so very quietly. Todd Bookman has the backstory to one of the great American inventions.
When your mother is a knockout, this undoubtedly affects the path your life takes.
He was always very aware of aesthetics because his mother was a model in New York City.
Joel Spira was family to not only lookers, but also very successful, driven people. His dad used to frequent speakeasies before gaining a seat on the state liquor board. His father-in-law started an electronics company, then a giant magazine publishing business.
His sister ended up going into the art world and became the number two at the Guggenheim. So there's always been this right brain, left brain, the arts and the sciences in our family, very Bauhaus.
This is Joel Spira's daughter, Susan Hockarinen. Following in the family tradition, she earned a PhD in applied plasma physics from MIT and is involved with several arts organizations. Her father, son of the model, served in the Navy during World War II, where he worked on radar systems. Then Spira went and got his physics degree before moving to New York City. It was there, in his Manhattan apartment in 1959, where Spira's tinkering would result in the device that forever changed the way humans see each other. It was a new type of transistor that dramatically shrunk the hardware required to lower the lights, the dimmer switch. Before his invention, there were dimmers in use in ballrooms and on Broadway and in other engineering applications, but they were often these very big, ungainly devices that had to be hidden in back rooms, where they emitted a ton of heat. Spira's advancement, his transistor, was small enough and safe enough to slip into electrical boxes in the wall. It functions sort of like the way a dam controls the amount of water moving through. Picture a gate opening and closing rapidly, letting in little bursts of power.
You can turn on and shut off something very, very fast, right? It's almost like extreme flickering of a light. And if you turn it on and off fast enough, our eyes kind of aggregate that light and it looks like it's actually less light. And that's really all that's happening. So it's basically a super fast light switch that makes it feel like the light is at a much lower intensity.
Brent Protzman is an engineer at Lutron Electronics, the company Joel Spira formed when he began production of the dimmer switch in the 1960s. The headquarters are still in Coopersburg, just outside of Allentown, Pennsylvania. In the early days, Lutron didn't market its dimmer to electricians or contractors. Instead, they wanted to appeal to a different audience, to women, to wives interested in perhaps generating a little extra spice at home. Picture Betty Draper bored in the suburbs. The company called its dimmer the Capri. Susan Hockarinen says every detail of the ad campaign was considered, right down to the packaging.
He was looking for a box that was attractive, and he found that a company did an overrun of perfume boxes. This box manufacturer had these beautiful perfume boxes, and he said, you know what, I'll take these off your hands and just print my name on it. And these were beautiful boxes when everybody else was doing industrial boxes.
Along with the nice boxes, he set up displays in New York department stores like E.J. Corvette's, so women could experience the dial for themselves. A side-by-side promotional photo showed a stay-at-home mom sipping coffee under bright lights. But when they get dimmed, out comes a domestic goddess, a half acre of décolletage on display, her face softly burning with desire.
the theme in the early days was dial romance.
Michael Pessina is the current president of Lutron. He says the Don Draper style campaign was built around the idea that kids could still do their homework after school at the dining room table. But once they were safely tucked in, the adults could ponder making more kids at the turn of a knob.
Because there's nothing more romantic than that beautiful flicker of a candlelight. And the dimming technology could allow that to happen. So any light for any need or any use of the space. And the dining room was a nice place for that.
The dimmer soon expanded beyond the dining room and into the living room and eventually the bedroom. It gave these spaces access to the secrets of Hollywood lighting designers.
If you do the lighting well, the shadows on your face are interesting and dynamic. So it actually, as you move, you watch each other's faces and you look attractive, but it's also interesting and dynamic.
The soft light softens hard edges, the wayward hairs, the bags under our eyes. It seemingly glances off surfaces rather than spotlighting them. But does it actually kickstart our libido in a more primal way? That's the question I posed to this guy.
Name and title?
I'm Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones. I'm lead guitarist. Is that the right level of sound?
Yes, but your real name and title.
Oh, my real name. Well, I have an alter ego. I'm George Brainerd, a professor of neurology at Thomas Jefferson University.
Brainerd, who I would have pegged more a Simon and Garfunkel guy, has spent his career studying light's impact on humans. In fact, he says you should think of light like a drug, in that the quantity consumed correlates with a measurable chemical change in the body, a response. So does dim light work like a prescription drug on us, kickstarting our desires?
I think it's excellent marketing, but I'm afraid I can't cite the science behind it.
Okay, no one has proven that the dimmer is the little blue pill or pink pill on the wall, but Brainerd says that doesn't mean dim light doesn't influence our behavior.
We know for a fact, things that I can say with more clarity, is when you dim the light in the evening, you hasten the onset of the production of the hormone melatonin. That's related to calming the body down, preparing it for sleep. And of course, romance is something we often do around the time of sleep. So you're gearing down from the heavy workday, slowing the pace, and perhaps getting in the mood.
In its 50-plus years on the market, the dimmer has evolved into something far more than a romantic tool. Bill Bram is an architect at the University of Pennsylvania, where he leads a program on sustainable design.
The dimmer has found a whole bunch of new uses, but primary among them is the saving of energy.
Less light uses less electricity, plus lower light helps light bulbs last longer. Joel Spira and Lutron knew this from the beginning, and now they, along with other dimmer manufacturers, market this angle along with the aesthetic one. Bigger buildings, think airports and skyscrapers, use dimmers to cut costs. And a lot of modern offices strategically dim lights at certain times.
So the dimmed light in the office is typically, if it's being done well, is being dimmed in response to the amount of daylight available, to keep the amount of light constant, to save energy. All of which is still in the service of making you work as hard as you can as for as many hours as you can, which I would describe as the opposite of what you do when you come home or what you want to do when you come home and what the dimmed light at the table or the candle at the table helps you to achieve.
Lutron now sells thousands of other products, including electronic window shades and other energy-conscious devices. And while Joel Spira is named on hundreds of patents, it will be the dimmer switch that he's forever linked. In 2010, the original was added to the Smithsonian's collection. Michael Pessina, the current president, joined Spira at the unveiling.
I knew him almost 39 years, and I rarely heard him a loss for words. But I remember we were standing there before the case was unveiled with where the product was. I said to him, I leaned over and I said, Chief, this is a pretty big deal. And he said to me, oh, this is about everybody. This is about everybody. And as they opened and took the shroud off the case, there was one of Alexander Graham Bell's original telegraphs there was a Thomas Edison light bulb, and there was Joel Spira's light dimmer, first notebook, and original prototype. And I looked at him, and he couldn't say a word. I just said, it is a big deal, and he just went and shook his head.
Joel Spira was still the face of the company when he passed away in April of this year at the age of 88. He's survived by his wife of six decades, Ruth, and their three daughters. The first line of his obituary in the New York Times said he was a man who, quote, changed the ambiance of homes around the world and encouraged romantic seductions of all types.
He would have been tickled pink with that, because I'll tell you, their code names for each other, which has never been told publicly, is Big Ben and Ruby Begonia. You know, they were old-time, I think, movie references, but they would sign birthday cards to each other and Valentine cards, so they were always romantic. And we'd always get, from my father, all of us daughters would get chocolates on Valentine's Day from your secret admirer.
Chocolates, love notes, nicknames. This guy was smooth. And with his invention, the rest of us could feel a little smoother, too. For Word of Mouth, I'm Todd Bookman.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you're a big Red Sox fan, there's a pretty good chance that you also hate the New York Yankees. For many years, an impromptu chorus of Yankees suck would erupt at Fenway Park, no matter who the Sox were playing. That rivalry and that phrase gave rise to the Yankees Suck t-shirts, which were produced on a shoestring by a bunch of hardcore punks and went on to become the most popular t-shirts in Boston history. Amos Barshad is staff writer for Grantland, and he follows the rise and fall of the drug-fueled, violent, and highly lucrative empire behind the once ubiquitous shirt. Amos Barshad, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So you write about the very first Yankee Suck t-shirt, actually a promotion for a hardcore band. So what's that connection there between the Boston music scene and sports at that time?
There was a group of guys who used to sell peanuts and beer and water and stuff inside Fenway. And a lot of these guys, the way they knew each other was from going to hardcore shows and playing in hardcore bands, which in that genre of music was very popular in Boston at the time, kind of late 90s, early 2000s. And so just by being around Fenway and all of them being big Sox fans, you know, they would hear the Yankees Suck chant all the time. And, you know, you'd see it on a shirt here and there, or, you know, whatever it would be, maybe a homemade one, you know, that kind of thing existed, you know, it was out there. But no one had really tried to industrialize it in any way. So kind of on a whim, these guys, to celebrate the last show from one of their favorite bands, 10 Yard Fight, they printed up a bunch of shirts that said Yankees Suck on the front and 10 Yard Fight on the back with the date of the last show. And, you know, they were just kind of doing it for their friends and the fellow fans and not thinking too much about it. But, you know, it was a big hit. They were surprised at how easily they were managed to sell them. And soon thereafter, they decided to kind of go into business specifically with these shirts.
Well, tell us a little bit about that evolution, going from being a way to make a couple bucks and acknowledge a band's last gig to a substantial business operation with its own printing press and distribution system of sorts.
Yeah. I mean, the way they tell it all happened so fast, and they just kind of had to keep up. You know, at first they were using a guy in New Jersey who printed up a lot of the hardcore band's shirts. You know, the way, you know, hardcore works in a lot of punk bands too, it's like you're not necessarily in it to make money, you're in it to have a good time. So you form bands and you break up pretty quickly as soon as you stop having fun. So, you know, these guys would just throw out a quick orders of shirts through this guy. So it would just always be like limited order stuff. But once these guys realized that they wanted to keep this going and they realized they could make some money doing it, they branched out, they rented a place, and they just kind of started calling in all their pals, all these kids that were, you know, punk kids, you know, some of them in school, some of them are not, just all of them, you know, looking to make money and looking to hang out. So they quickly had like packs of guys working for them, working the entrances to Fenway, working certain spots. And at the time, they just popped up out of nowhere and, you know, could stand right there, right outside where the reputable businesses were, and just kind of, you know, hawking these cheaper, funnier, cruder shirts and kind of stealing attention away from everyone. And they were, you know, brash young kids. And so they just loved to just get in there and mix it up with, you know, Sox fans, drunk or not. You know, everyone kind of yelled at each other. It became this rambunctious scene at any given time, you know, before and after after the game when everyone was streaming in and out.
So who was in this group and how many people in their kind of core group and then the extended distribution network?
There was four main guys, this guy Ray LeMoyne and his friends, Todd Wilson, Jamie Manza, and another guy called Eric Ferenz, and everyone called him Rusty. And they were the main guys that kind of spearheaded the whole thing. You know, classic, like, heist movie. They all kind of had some roles, you know, allocated out. You know, Ray was kind of more of the leader of the brains. Todd Wilson was known to be a bit more of the enforcer. You know, Jamie and Rusty were more behind the scenes and maybe a bit more party forward kind of guys. But, you know, more or less they were all just friends and excited about the music and excited about the Sox and excited more than anything that they had all this money, all this cash to spend in ridiculous ways together.
So they sort of sound like drug dealers, and you kind of compared the way that they set up their operation a little bit like drug dealers. How's that?
Yeah. I think for the longest time when I was working on the story and trying to explain it to people, I was referring to them as baby drug dealers. And, you know, I think that's true, and I think they were happy to go along with it. I mean, of course, selling, you know, T-shirts that where the copyright is in question is not comparable to selling drugs. But these guys were happy to play the part at the very least. And I think there always was a bit of a kind of a winking recognition that this was all a bit ridiculous, you know. But, you know, they did have the cops on them after a little while, and specifically the code enforcers. And they did have this guy, Chris Tiger Stockbridge, and he was the one known to be the most vigilant from the code enforcers. At the same time, he was a quite large man, so there would be a lot of, you know, kind of comical foot races between a grown adult of a certain size chasing these skinny young kids around all through Fenway. You know, it would just be scenes like that. Would pop up all the time. So it's like, you know, you're thinking about it as if you're being watched, and you know you're doing something that's quasi-illegal. So, you know, why not embrace the whole mentality and pretend to be these outlaw kids? And, you know, that's kind of what they did. You know, they made their money fast. They spent it fast. They all lived together in these kind of flop houses in the Mission Hill neighborhood of Boston. And they, you know, embraced a certain kind of lifestyle that would, you know, generally be in line with something of a more extreme illegality.
Well, paint a picture for us of this house that they're all living in and their travels, the way that they sort of move around as a posse, to give us a sense of, like, how debauched this really was.
I mean, the way I understand it, they went from not doing much of anything. Hardcore music is associated with straight edge, which is a movement basically that if you say you're straight edge, you don't drink, you don't do drugs, you're very careful about, you know, what you do with your body. And a lot of these kids had come out of that. And, you know, it's not to say just because they had money that they started breaking edge, as it's called, but it seemed to certainly not hurt because all of a sudden they had money to buy pills. You know, Vicodin was rampant. You know, it became a thing where they had this house in Mission Hill, and they named it the Gentleman's Club. And basically, people knew if you were looking for a party, you could stop by there at any given time. And, you know, people passed out on the couches, passed out on the floors. You know, any given room was a wreck, and drugs and booze and, you know, sometimes strippers. You know, it's like you have money and you're just trying to figure out ways to blow it. I mean, that's basically what it was. Any kind of vice they could get their hands on, they love to take part in.
Yeah, I can kind of imagine the montage and even the music for the Ben Affleck-directed film of this now.
Yeah, if he's listening, you know, holler at me, Affleck.
Any of idea how much money they were making?
It's hard to say. Any given night, they'd maybe have 20 or so guys out there, and then each of those guys is making, like, taking home maybe $100 or something. It's hard to say who was getting what cut. You know, the four main guys would kind of get a cut off of every shirt. But, you know, they're printing these shirts for 50 cents or a dollar. So, you know, easily get up to tens of thousands on any given week, depending on, of course, if the Sox are home and if the Yankees are there, which, of course, leads to more sales. And, you know, certain days, you know, sales would spike. You know, they always talked about Marathon Day, Patriots Day. So, you know, there's certain days where they knew how to work it more. And certain sellers were just, you know, more active. There was this one kid that everyone talked about, Jonathan Cho, and he apparently, you know, just kind of see guys coming out, throw a shirt on before they could even say anything, be like, all right, that's $10, you know, just hustling. You know, they're out there just pushing it and hustling. And if you wanted to, you know, you could really get some nice pocket money for yourself.
Well, at some point they were, you know, wearing expensive watches, traveling to Europe, you know, having these sort of junkets like drug dealers do. And you refer to them as the suckers. Is that how they talk about themselves, or is that a name that you gave them?
They would say, you know, let's talk about the days of sucking or something like that. They would kind of make it into a verb. I think the suckers came out through the story. You know, we needed a way to identify the group. But yeah, they would kind of jokingly be like, oh, let's reminisce about the old days of sucking. They would have that kind of terminology.
Was what they were doing legal?
You know, it's hard to say that it was fully legal, but in their defense, the phrase Yankee Suck wasn't trademarked. So as far as that goes, it wasn't necessarily a copyright infringement. There are certain rules about where you can sell your goods in relation to other businesses. So I think, you know, in the sense of fair businessman practices, they were probably infringing on things like that. But, you know, as their lawyer said to me, you know, ultimately you were these young guys who figured out how to make money. You know, there was obviously a demand for this. They were tapping into something that really was there, you know, that kind of bitterness and the hatred, and of course that phrase, it was almost inevitable that someone would be able to make money doing this. And I think, you know, they weren't that interested in becoming a reputable business. They enjoyed doing it the way they wanted to. The truth is, if they had looked to set up a brick and mortar store or something like that, maybe that's a route they could have gone down, but that was not something they were interested in. You know, I think they were enjoying playing with the gray area. I mean, I think even the cops were, you know, aware that it wasn't absolutely clear what was legal and what was not, because up to that point, you know, you had the stores, you had the guys inside Fenway selling. There just wasn't this situation where there were guys running around selling shirts out of trash bags. So they had to kind of figure it out as they went along. The way they say it, you know, they'd have their shirts confiscated by cops just because, you know, the cops were going to like a barbecue the next day and wanted to hand the shirts out to their friends. You know, they claim that certain times, you know, they'd go in front of judges and the judge would be like, all right, you get off and toss me a shirt. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, it's Boston, you know, the judge is most likely a Sox fan and hates the Yankees. So it's really hard for him to see this kid selling Yankee Suck shirts and not have some compassion towards him.
Well, it's huge success. So, of course, other vendors were trying to step on their stuff, too, and print their own Yankee Suck material. How did they deal with those infringers?
Yeah, there was definitely a spike in competition once they realized that would happen. It seemed, for the most part, It was kind of piecemeal. You know, a guy would show up with a couple of his buddies and be like, well, you guys are doing it, why can't we? And of course, he was absolutely right to do it or attempt to. But the fact is, you know, that's not how these guys saw it. So in their opinion, that was grounds for physical confrontation, at the very least some verbal. And, you know, there was incidents where guys' shirts were being thrown, you know, onto the Mass Pike, or someone would dump a soda all over them. You know, just make it very clear that it was going to be a hostile environment if you're going to show up and try to do that. And again, you know, I think the way they tell the stories, you know, they're aware of the ridiculousness of having a turf war over T-shirts. But, you know, that's what it came down to. And so if that was going to happen, that's how they were going to play it. You know, if people wanted to try and get in on their game, you know, it was going to have to be a battle over it.
I'm speaking with Amos Barshad, he's staff writer for Grantland, and he recently chronicled the bizarre history of the Yankees Suck T-shirt and the gang-like group of kids made hundreds of thousands of dollars banking on the long and bitter sports rivalry between the Yankees and the Red Sox. Well, things really changed for the Yankees Suck T-shirt in the 2004 World Series win for the Red Sox. How did that change Fenway Park and the nature of the Suckers business?
Yeah, the win is so funny because it's obviously was so coveted for so long, but that's the thing. Once you win, you're not an underdog anymore. And the identity of Boston and Sox in particular was of this plucky underdog and, you know, getting beat always at the last minute, but always being in there and fighting and, you know, making sure to display all the heart that they had. And once you win, and, you know, obviously the Sox budget payroll is not that dissimilar to the Yankees, all of a sudden what's to stop you from just becoming the new Yankees? And, you know, in large part that is what happened. You know, there were all these bandwagon fans. The pink hat became something where people debated a lot. You know, you'd see kind of new fans, maybe younger female fans who are enjoying the good spirited nature that comes after a championship. And of course, why wouldn't they? And, you know, going along with it, going out to buy a new pink hat, and you'd have all these like crusty old Boston dudes just being like, they're not real fans. They weren't there in the beginning, you know, and it's a funny thing. And also, represents, I think, the changing of the city and especially the changing of the area surrounding Fenway. I think people that were there back then remember it was a dirtier, grimier place. It was the kind of place that you really could get in a fight if you were looking for it, and sometimes if you weren't. I spoke with Peter Gammons, you know, the great, great baseball writer who was at the Globe for a long time and ESPN. And, you know, he was remembering being at games with his wife and people cursing and him having to turn around and ask for them to stop cursing in front of kids. Like, this was a regular thing you'd have to do. And these days at Fenway, you know, it's a, definitely a premier family-friendly outing. And it's just bizarre and it's great, you know. Ultimately, of course, you want people to feel safe and you want things to be clean. But you know, for me and for other people that were there observing that back around then, I grew up in Brookline, which is a suburb outside of Boston, so it wasn't like I was there throwing punches or anything. But, you know, I just remember hearing stories and seeing, you know, kind of a dirtier, grimier place. And it's silly, but, you know, you can really get nostalgic for something like that.
Yeah, I've seen a number of sports writers just say, it's time to retire, the whole Yankees suck thing. What's your thought?
You know, I will always have some residual hatred for them. I don't even, you know, to be fully honest, I kind of stopped watching baseball after that World Series win as well. I just kind of lost some interest, as weird as it is. The truth is that, yeah, you know, it doesn't represent what it did, and the rivalry isn't as bitter. And so when you hear it now, it's almost strange, you know, kind of if someone were to try to burst out with it, I can imagine, you know, hearing some silence, you know, echoing afterwards. But, you know, for a time there was just wherever you were, if there was a group of people, you know, you would hear that. I mean, people that I talked to remember hearing it at funerals, even bar mitzvahs, weddings, you know, insane things like that.
So
and I
crazy.
Remember, I remember after the Pats won, the Patriots won in 2001, we all streamed down to Kenmore Square and celebrated, and it was an amazing, joyous thing. And it took about 45 seconds for some genius to start yelling "Yankees suck," and it had nothing to do with anything, but it was just the loudest I've ever heard a group of people yell "Yankees suck" after the Patriots had won the Super Bowl. It made no sense.
Well, it has been more than a decade since the Red Sox won in 2004. And one of the people that you speak to says, you know, looking outside of Fenway Park now, it looks like Dubai. And I've been there recently. It's absolutely transformed. So where are the Suckers now? What are they doing?
They're kind of all over the place. I think a part of the story that drew me to it is that they did have some splintering. The way they talked about it is, you know, they didn't necessarily work on their relationship. You know, they realized they were kind of living fast, and as soon as that money starts falling apart or people start arguing about money, or as soon as there was just more trouble related to operating their business, it stopped being as fun, and some of them kind of splintered away. But they're all doing well in their own respective regards. Ray LeMoyne is a journalist. I think he's currently still in the Ukraine. And Jamie Manza is out in upstate New York, involved with it's called Cobb Building. It's kind of an organic building technique. Mm-hmm. Todd Wilson is in Albany, you know, doing construction. You know, these guys are kind of all over the place doing their own thing, and those guys don't really talk. But LeMoyne is still close with a lot of the guys that he sold shirts with, and they're all still buddies.
Well, an amazing story. Thank you so much for talking with us about it, Amos.
Thank you for having me.
Amos Barshad, he's staff writer for Grantland, and you'll find a link to read his absolutely entertaining article for Grantland about the rise and fall of the Suckers at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Take Chicago's experimental music scene and mix in the African influences and bossa nova traditions of Brazil, and you get the São Paulo Underground, a genre-defying trio led by composer Rob Mazurek. The São Paulo Underground is performing tomorrow at the 3S Art Space in Portsmouth. Producer Taylor Quimby caught up with Mazurek earlier this week.
This is Rob Mazurek. I play cornet and electronics. Started playing cornet at the age of 10. Started making records around the mid-80s. Started the São Paulo Underground 10 years ago. So this is the 10th anniversary of São Paulo Underground. The electronics that we utilize are very varied. We use samplers, we use analog synthesizers, we use digital feedback modules, Lately, I've been using a modular synthesizer made with Make Noise modules. So we use all these machines, and drum machines as well. The electronics have become such an important part of just the sound of the thing that whether acoustic or electronic, it's really, it's become one sound, one type of sound.
Talking about one kind of sound, but at the same time, you know, there's a couple things that you're doing, and I wonder how do you stay within a tradition, and in this case we're talking about Brazilian music, while at the same time sort of pushing it beyond its boundaries. You know, I wonder if there's a point at which something is no longer, you know, it's no longer what it started out as.
Right. I mean, I think for me the best art and the best groups and the best things I've heard and experienced in life are things that transcend that go past that have an evolution of a thing while retaining the tradition like we're talking about here. So although Mauricio and Guilherme, born in São Paulo and have been a part of that Brazilian music scene for a long time, they're also very learned and heavy into the hardcore scene and punk scene and free jazz scene. And we take all those elements and try to incorporate them into what we do early on, and I think finally at this point we're starting to hit upon our own evolution of a sound. Maybe people think they're playing the tradition and that's forward in the tradition, but I think by just sticking with tradition, you're hurting the tradition. You know what I mean? This song is called The Love I Feel For You Is More Real Than Ever. I mean, this song is about my wife. We got married in Sardinia, Italy, 3 years ago. We've been together for 8 years. And São Paulo Underground was invited to play at the Santa Ana Arese Jazz Festival. And I told the director of the festival that I couldn't come because me and my wife were planning our wedding in Chicago at the time. So, and then the director of the festival said, "Well, why don't you get married here in Sardinia at the festival?" And I was like, "That's a crazy idea. Let's do it."
So I've got one last question for you. It's kind of a stupid one, but it's one that I've always been curious with.
Right.
So how do you go about naming an instrumental song?
I mean, you know, I read a lot. One of my favorite authors in the world is Samuel R. Delaney, the great writer of science fiction and many other things. I read a lot. I love poetry. You know, I love text. You know, a lot of these titles just kind of pop into my head and we write them down, and it's just a matter of being as interested in that as much as we're interested in the sound, as much as we're interested in the artwork, as much as we're interested in, you know, the food we eat. It's all like a complete interest in the beautiful and interesting things in life.
Rob Mazurek there of the São Paulo Underground speaking with producer Taylor Quimby. You can learn more about their performance tomorrow night at the 3S Art Space and check out some more of their music at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today, and there's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you can sign up for our podcast and listen whenever it suits your schedule. And if you dig that kind of convenience, do us a favor and write a review or rate it on iTunes. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more word of mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.